Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series. That's toughmantri.com. By VeloFix, the coolest mobile bike shop. By Polar, chase your destiny. By Premium Plus Sports, the official travel provider of the Tough Man Triathlon Series. By our Challenged Athletes Foundation, last year we sent out 2,448 grants, totaling $3.7 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check out any of our interviews on Babbittville.com or on iTunes. And as always, endurance lives here. Next up, a young woman who just ran 7 half marathons in 7 days, and believe this or not, on 7 continents. Sarah Reinertsen joins us. I'm sure a little sleep deprived and a little sore. How you doing, Sarah?
I'm doing all right, Bob. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh man, we go back a lot of years, Sarah. We go back to when you were setting marathon records as the fastest single above knee amputee, and then on the track, and then watching you go to Paralympic Games in '92, and on the cover of ESPN, Runner's World, competitor, triathlete. You've done so much over the years. When you first started participating as an athlete, again, as a single above knee amputee, did you have any sense of where that was going to lead?
Yeah, I had no idea that running would take me to all 7 continents, you know.
Yeah.
I was, you know, as a little girl from Long Island, I thought, you know, maybe the New York Marathon, like, you know, in the city down the road. But, yeah, I never thought that I would be talking to you after doing all 7 continents in a week, no less.
Well, and you've been such a trailblazer. When I look back at, you know, every time you ran a marathon, you were setting a new world record for that division. So you set a world record, and your first New York was 98, then world record in New Zealand, world record in London. It's like one after another. Then the first above the amputee to do Ironman World Championship, ESPY Award, on the Amazing Race. I mean, I'm sure because you're living it now, it's hard to go, oh my God, there was a lot of stuff over all these years, and that sort of led to this. Take me back to when you first heard about this crazy thing. And what were your first thought about the World Marathon Challenge when someone said, hey, I got an idea. Let's do a little travel and a little running.
Yeah, I had actually heard about this event. A CAF supporter, Winston Fisher, had done this race. And then, you know, we heard Ryan Hall had done this race as well, too. But the real impetus, the reason why it all started and the seed was planted for me was because of CAF board member David Sampson. And I know him through Ironman. He did the Hawaii Ironman. And raised money for CAF. That's how we got the slot to go over to Kona. So I knew him, and I got to be in Kona when he did that and finished that course. He's done a lot of crazy things, too. He's been on Survivor. And so he called me up and said, hey, Sarah, I have the next event that you should do. And I'm putting together this team. I want this philanthropic effort, and I want us to do this race, this World Marathon Challenge, 7 marathons, 7 days, 7 continents. And, you know, I'd only heard about it briefly, as I said, from those other athletes, Winston and Ryan, but when David, you know, said, hey, let's do this thing, I actually didn't do that much homework. I just said yes.
Right.
You know, I think sometimes in life you just have to say yes. And,
exactly.
And I knew that this was one of those moments, and I was like, yes, I can't even fathom the training and what you need to do, but, like, yes, I want to do this. And especially with it, you know, having a philanthropic component, I was all in. And when you've done so much, it's really hard to sometimes find that next thing. I mean, I'm even finding that now. Like,
right.
I'm
what's
answering
next?
The question,
yeah.
Now what? But you know, when he called me, it was just like, wow, that's something that hasn't been done and I would love to do. So I immediately said yes, and thus the journey began.
And no challenged athlete had attempted this before, right?
No, no amputee athlete had attempted it before. There was an athlete, a visually impaired athlete, who had done the race before, which is a huge feat
God,
but again, they have their feet. So I just thought, it would be really cool to see if I could actually do this thing on a prosthetic leg and go the distance. And David had all the faith in the world in me, and I just sort of kicked off the training
So
we knew we were going to do this for about a year and a half, 2 years. So,
but the hard part is, it's one thing when you're talking about somebody whose legs get sore after a run, you're dealing with a stump, right? And you're dealing with a lot of pressure on that stump. And so you sort of have a fine line. You could say, okay, I'm going to be running a half marathon a day for 7 days in a row. So in training, I'll run 10 miles a day. I mean, you sort of have to have a balance between, I got to get to the starting line. And I can't beat myself up too much. How did you balance all that?
Yeah, you know, in the training, you know, especially being a triathlete, that was a really good thing. I mean, I still had to do a lot of back-to-back miles to prepare.
Mm-hmm.
And originally, I went into this thinking I would do fulls, you know. So I do feel, you know, I ended up doing the halves, but I did think I would be doing the fulls. And so we had a training program that was a lot of, you know, running twice on Saturday and then another run on Sunday morning.
Wow.
So you would do some major miles that way. But to your point earlier, you know, when you do wear a prosthetic leg, I do get sometimes just some chafing and some stump sores or some blisters, and you know, you just got to take off your leg to let that heal and stuff. So there, I did incorporate as well some cycling and some other non-impact training. You know, cycling doesn't always transfer to the run in the same way, but at least I would just get that cardio. But I still needed to, you know, I still needed the run miles, you know,
right,
and that back-to-back, getting used to just running right away. Because when we were racing, we would race, you know, it's a seven-day race, but you're running sometimes, it's shorter than a 24-hour period. You know, between our Antarctica race and our Cape Town race, I mean, it was less than, I think, 11-hour difference by the time we finished and got to the next one. So
how many people total were on the plane?
So we had, like, there were 50 competitors, actually one guy, so 51, and one guy did drop out when we got to Dubai. He just had some bad luck with illness and injury. But so we had the competitors, and then there was, just the crew, like the race director, the timing person. We did have a doctor that went with us. So there were 50 people, and I would say 20 total crew. And then also there was one other competitor that was doing the halves as well. So we had about 51, and then, and then the crew.
It's so funny, because when you think about this from the outside, you're going, okay, so you're going to run a half marathon in, 3 hours, whatever that is. And then you got the rest of the day. But the reality is you're running in Antarctica, and then take us through, like, the time frame for the day, because you've got to finish the event, shower, change, get to the airport. I mean, it seems like there's a lot of stuff going on, and you never really have that downtime to say, okay, I'm going to get 8 hours of sleep in.
No, you didn't. Like, so, you know, the flight time between Antarctica and Cape Town is only 5 hours. So, there was, like, we knew that really the only sleep time we would have, those 5 hours, even if once you get food in you, that 5 hour flight is actually maybe 3 hours. You know, chop off an hour on each end, right?
Right.
We're really down to 3 hours of maybe solid sleep, perhaps. You know, but so that's how it was. And in Antarctica, you know, when we landed there, we actually got the race kind of done, but the pilot is the same. So your pilot has to rest.
Right.
The pilot just can't turn around and get on a plane again, right?
Oh, that's
right. Legally, they have to have a certain amount of rest before they can get back on the plane and fly you back. So we did have a little bit of time in Antarctica where we were allowed to, after the race, we slept in these, like, cabins, kind of shipping containers that had, like, bunk beds and stuff in it, and we could just kind of crash out on that until we were cleared to get back on the plane. So we did have a little bit of extra extra time. But, I mean, we still had, like, 17 girls to these bunk beds and, you know, a lot of chattering and stuff. So I didn't get much rest, even in Antarctica. So when I got on the plane, you know, you're going into the first race already sleep-deprived, that first Cape Town. And the temperature extremes. So, you know, you land, you've just finished a race in Antarctica, and you peel off your polar clothes, right, on the plane,
yeah.
And you're changing into your Cape Town clothes. And as soon as you land, then you're heading off to the race start in Cape Town. And it's like we've gone from, you know, -4 to now it's like 89 degrees.
Oh, my God, you know? A 90-degree temperature swing. That's amazing.
Yeah, right. Dave McGilvery said it best. It was like from the freezer to the oven.
Oh, that's,
you know,
unbelievable. So, and also, you are wearing a prosthetic leg on ice. I can't imagine that is the best combination.
Yeah. It was super. I mean, look, I planned for it,
yes,
as best as I could. I got
you got your little track spikes on there?
Yeah, I got a so I wear the Flex Run when I run. So
yeah,
it's not a foot that has the same kind of footing, right? It's when we're running on those things, even on regular surface, it's not the same type of footing that you would have,
right.
But especially on the ice, in that Nike sole, what we added was some spikes so that I could use that in the ice, and that helped me grip, but at the same time, it was such a varying terrain, so I prepared for ice, but I forgot about, there were snow drifts in certain parts.
Oh, wow.
So you would go from like super, like kind of deep snow drifts
yeah,
to suddenly really icy to suddenly not so, like kind of crunchier snow to sort of super slick ice. Like it was just constantly varying, and the way the winds were too. We basically did the course was running around the runway. So they have this blue ice runway that they keep pristine and they have it marked off. Like even the scientists that are there, you know, full time, they don't walk all over the runway. They have to keep that ready for their supplies to come in and for planes to take off. So we ran just sort of around that runway, and on one side of it, you had, you know, you would sort of kind of get warm because you're like, oh, the wind is at my back, right? And then as soon as you made that turn, the wind, it would be a headwind. So then your temperature, you'd be unzipping one direction on the lap, like just to ventilate and get some cool air. And then you'd turn the corner and you'd be suddenly freezing. So you'd be zipping everything up. And on that side, that's where we'd get more of the super deep snow drifts. So on one side, it was super ice and slicky, and I'd just be like holding on like ice skating. And then on the other side, then I'd be like trudging, you know. And it really, it took a lot more out of me than I had anticipated. You know, coming from New York, I've run in inclement weather. You know, I believe that there's no such thing as bad weather, just bad clothing, right? Like,
right,
if you got the right gear,
yeah,
you can
yep,
handle anything. But, and I would run in New York City in bad weather, but even on icy roads, you put those spikes over your sneakers because they never shoveled my
right,
block in Brooklyn too quickly. So I always had those spikes, and I'd still go for a run with those to grip the ice. But once you cut through the ice, you get to concrete, right? And you could grip a little better. But in Antarctica, you cut through the ice, there's just more ice, you know? And it's not like, it was just really hard to get my footing on that. And I, you know, I don't know if I could have prepared for it any better, but it just, by the time I got through a couple laps, I was like, all right, I'm not doing the full, I'm going to do the half. And parts of my body hurt in a way that I wasn't used to. I could just tell that I was overusing my muscles. Like, you know, my low back normally doesn't hurt the way it did that race because, you know, I'm seasoned enough. I know
right,
how my body reacts, and I could just feel it breaking down.
Well,
and, yeah, and I knew I had 6 more days to go. So
right,
I tapped out, and I did, and that was my slowest race. I did a 3:21. So it was a pretty slow half marathon, but I was just stoked to finish.
Yeah. Well, and also, you think about it, you don't have any solid footing.
Yeah.
And for somebody who's, you know, got a prosthetic leg on, you got a natural imbalance anyways. So you're basically skating, which means you're using parts of your body that you really haven't used. And
yeah,
that's, and I'm sure when you got on the plane, you're like, man, I'm in sore in places I didn't even know I had.
Yeah, that's exactly how it was. And I just thought, oh, my God, I have 6 more days to go, you know. So My ego had to get out of it, and I had to, like, think more long term. And,
right.
and being an endurance athlete, you know that, right? Like, getting through Ironman is all about energy management,
yeah.
and I knew I had to approach it the same way for this, so...
So what did your routine become? Because all of us are sort of stewards to our routine where we finish something. Okay, get my drink in, get my food in, get my nap, get my legs wrapped up. What was your procedure after each run?
Yeah, you know, you have your routine and you try to stick to it as much as you can, but like the routine I wanted wasn't always there. So for example, in Antarctica is a good example in the sense that like so after the race, then you got out of that. Like race clothing, and we still had to put on like fresh snow clothes, right?
Yeah.
Because you're still hanging out. But you know, I brought some recovery food with me, but basically we got like sausages and coleslaw, which is the same stuff like that the science guys
right.
or the Russian science guys are eating. So it's not like you could have, you know, the protein that you wanted or the type of recovery meal you would ideally have at your house. You just kind of had to eat on the fly or whatever they had on the plane. So you kind of recover, you know, you finish that race and then you get into your recovery clothes. In Antarctica, we couldn't shower. But then you'd get on the plane and go to the next place. But in every other city after Antarctica, they would get us a hotel so that we never slept really in that hotel. A lot of times it would just be the place that we would shower after the race before going to the airport. So like Cape Town, we finished the race in the late afternoon. We were able to go back, shower, be back at the airport by 9 p.m. to fly to Perth. So we had the hotel room for that night, but we didn't stay. We basically just, after the race, like, got back to the hotel at 6, showered, changed, went to the airport, got on the plane at, like, 9, 10 o'clock at night, and flew. That was a 12 to 14-hour flight.
Oh,
and,
my God.
I mean, we were so excited. It was like after that quick turnaround between Antarctica and Cape Town, we were just so stoked. Like, a 12-hour flight, you can get a good 7 to 8 hours of sleep.
Yeah.
And that was awesome. I think that's why I had a good race in Perth, is that I actually slept. So then, you know, we land in Perth, and we got there maybe 4 in the afternoon. We started the race by 9 o'clock in the evening that night. And you run, you run all day. I felt badly, you know, I'm doing the half, they're doing the full. So you imagine if I finish... We started at 9 o'clock at night. I'm finishing at midnight, 12:45. They're getting done almost, you know, an hour to 2 hours after that.
Right.
And then you go back to the hotel, shower, change. We had to be out downstairs in the lobby by, you know, 6 or 7 in the morning.
Oh my gosh! You just lose track of day and night, and it just sort of blends.
You don't even get used to a time zone. It's
right.
Like I started to feel like a vampire. We would sleep on a plane all day, hit the ground, and run somewhere at night, and then the next morning just get back on a plane and fly all day. And, you know, because a lot of the races were done at night. Like Perth was at night, Dubai was at night, Lisbon, Cartagena were all evening races. So.
Was a course marked? So you know, because it's not like you got thousands of people to follow. I mean, that's got to be a tough part. Even though you've got that background from Amazing Race, it's still a different gig.
Yeah, I was good at like the travel and racing, but yeah, that when you're doing these courses, we're not meeting up. It was funny because we felt like we were following a lot of races. Like the Dubai Ironman was the morning that we did our race.
Oh,
you
wow!
Know?
Yeah.
So you know, you felt like, well, they just had their race, but we're just doing our own thing. We're just 50 people that are running up and down the beach, you know. But by the time I got to Perth, that's also where I started to run with music, too, because. I needed a little inspiration out there as you're just kind of going back and forth,
yep.
You know, and sometimes it would be kind of lonely out there.
Oh,
you know,
absolutely.
Sometimes you'd run with people, but I found that the music really helped me, you know, to kind of make the course interesting. Because when it was these lap courses, it was very clearly marked. Sometimes in cities, it wasn't as obvious as when we had a straight-up loop. Like Antarctica, you couldn't get lost, right, running around the runway. But
right.
In Perth, we were in a park, and that was very clearly marked. But, you know, it wasn't like you were with thousands of people, and there was, like, all these interesting things to look at during the day or people to talk to. I mean, a lot of times I like to race and hear the sound of the race. you know, of the people, of the crowd.
The cheering, absolutely, yeah.
But this was a little different. I was like, okay, I'm in the dark of night of Australia, and, you know.
Yeah. If I take a wrong turn, I'm a resident.
Yeah. So,
That's wild.
Yeah.
So when you're out there, it's funny when you have something mentally, you're so good at this as a triathlete, right? You go, okay, rather than going, oh, I've got a 2.4 mile swim, it's, oh, I'm halfway to the turnaround. You start making little positives every time you're doing stuff. So I'm sure those first couple half marathons, you're thinking, oh my God, I got six more to go. I got five. But when did you start feeling like, hey, I've done three of these. I only got three left.
Yeah. No, I would have to say well, first of all, getting to Antarctica, that was the one I was most nervous about.
Yeah.
But even though, like, I still had six to go, I did feel like, okay, the hardest one is ticked off. Kind of the hardest one, the more of the unknown. But Perth or Australia for me was where the event turned around. And I credit a couple things to that. You know, we talk about the music, but I have a strong connection with the country of Australia. My coach, McKeely Jones, is Australian.
Yep.
So I could honestly literally hear MJ in my head, like exactly how she would say, like, come on, Sarah. Like, I felt like she was honestly with me on the course. So that really helped. And then they had, like, my favorite gummies, like my favorite Australian gummies out on the course. So it just felt really homey and hometown. And I just, like, I had such joy in the race. Like, I also crossed the finish line, like Greg Welch. Like, I always loved his joyful jump across the line in Kona in 1994. And so, like, when I came across, I wanted to emulate that, like, crazy jump that he did. And, and Sean Welch did it as well when she just raced this past year. So, you know, it was an homage to my Aussie athlete heroes when I did that race. Like, so that helped me dig deep. And that's when I did a 2:40-something.
Wow.
So I was, now I was like, okay, now I'm back. Now I'm back to more of how I feel, how I should be feeling when I do this distance, when I do these 21Ks. So that really turned it around for me. Perth was magical.
What's fascinating sometimes is we think about, oh my God, I'm racing every day or I'm running every day. And I've noticed that with cycling, sometimes you get stronger. Sometimes you just mentally, because you know, it's pretty simple. I'm going to get up in the morning, and I'm running, and then you don't have to think about a lot of other things besides just putting your foot in front of your prosthetic and then doing it again.
Yeah, it really was. It started to, you know, it was like, I've been doing this for years. I know I can do this. Just, like, get up and do it, you know? So it was really good. Perth really turned it around for me. But, you know, there are the highs and lows. So even though I had a high in Perth, it doesn't mean that I didn't have a bunch of lows waiting ahead for me.
Now, what were the lows? Where was that? Cartagena?
You know, Cartagena was tough. I won't lie about that. But for me, the real low was Lisbon. Lisbon was probably the lowest of the race, and
a lot of old streets.
I nearly dropped out in Lisbon. Actually,
was that
I was ready to be like, you know what? I've raced in Europe. Tick this off the box.
Yeah.
I'm done. Like, I can come back. I don't need to do it as part of this thing. I'm just going to drop out here. Maybe I'll run in Cartagena. I've already done Miami. Like, I was truly ready to quit because.
Really?
It was so. We had gotten to Lisbon, and it was raining, and it was cold. But we all knew it was going to be the coldest one, right? Because it's
Lisbon.
And it's also it's winter in Europe.
Yes, yeah.
You know, now we're on the other side of the equator, and it's really winter up on that side. So, you know, wherever you choose in February of Europe is probably going to be not like, you know, it's gonna be cold. But it also rained in Lisbon, and it wasn't just that. I mean, like I said, weather with the right clothing, you can handle it. But it was the surfaces that challenged me. They have this, like, white kind of polished stone that's put in these patterns on the sidewalks.
Yes, like a mosaic type of pattern type of thing.
So even walking from the hotel to the race start, with the rain, those stones are really slick.
Yep.
And as I was walking to the race start on my run leg, I'm kind of slip sliding. I had to grab on to a couple things as I was walking. I'm like, this is really slippery.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't have the option to wear ice spikes on this. Like, this
right.
is just, I have to go with what I have. And so we start the race, and it's like this slick white cobblestone, not like smaller pieces, so it was even slicker than the big stuff. But anyway, and then when you turn the corner on the back end, we had this deck. It was like a wooden deck along the ocean that had like a nice good layer of like algae and green and slime
God.
That made it slick when it was wet.
Oh, my God.
So you came off of that cobblestone, like slip sliding away, and then you got to this bridge that was over the water with these wet wood planks. And that was also quite treacherous. And then
you
turned on to the next thing, and it was more different types of cobble, but also slick. So I felt like I was back on the ice in Antarctica. It just started to wear me down.
Sure.
You know, we're doing these laps on this super slick surface, and, you know, and then I just started grabbing the railing. You know, I'm walking, and I just decided I got to walk because I don't want to fall. I still have all these races. I don't want to. And I haven't talked much about it, but I ruptured the finger in my right hand about a week before I left on one of my final training runs. I'm crossing the street, and I just stumbled because I was, like, taking my phone out of my pocket, doing something stupid, and I kind of stumbled because I couldn't pull it out of my fanny pack properly.
Yeah.
And I land, and so when I did that, I fell, and I didn't want to fall on my phone, so I kind of twisted my hand, but I landed right on my right on the tendon and ruptured the tendon in my right hand. So I have this splint on my hand, and so I just was nervous about falling
sure.
and injuring my good hand, like my right hand again. So I just wasn't as steady as normally as well. But it's my hand. It doesn't affect my running. But it was just an inconvenience. And when I was out there on the slippery stuff again with no spikes or anything to grip, I was like, wow, I got to be careful. I've already ruptured one tendon. Let's just get through this, you know. So, that one, I kind of lost it. I mean, I was crying out there, and I did think about giving up. Another competitor came up to me. He's like, how you doing? And I was like, I'm having a horrible day. I think I'm going to give up. I'm going to call it when I get to the line. And he was like, don't do it. Please don't do it. You know, like, you're going to regret it. You know, please don't. And then he kind of got teary and he started crying. And,
wow.
And I was just like, you know, so, and then I just kind of recorded a video and I talked to myself and I pulled over and I ate my jelly beans and I put on a better song and I was like, okay, you got to get it together. You know, I thought about so many things to kind of turn that mental game around to get back in it. You know, I thought about the kids from CAF that I've worked with. You know, I had, you know, there were kids that I knew were cheering for me. I got notes from people saying that, you know, they're hugging Sarah Bear a little tighter at night because, you know, thinking about where I'm running in the world and, you know, and I just thought about that. And I'm like, I can't let them down. I can't let my family down. I don't want to let Oser down. I don't want to let Nike down or CAF or, you know, and you
That's
start thinking about all the reasons why you're doing this. And you pull yourself back up, you know, and then Michael Franti song later and I'm dancing, you know, and I'm getting through the next lap, but that was a real low moment, you know, and any endurance racer knows that you're gonna hit the low moments, but that was really a low one for me.
When you mentioned Australia, I remember you telling me about Matilda, telling me about that little girl Matilda, and I'm sure that flashed in your mind too, because that was such a cool story, because you were over there, I think this is when, during the process of trying to qualify for the first ever para triathlon in Rio. Right? And how did you connect with this Matilda and her family?
Yeah, no, I absolutely thought of Matilda, and I sang Waltzing Matilda when I ran in Australia, of course. But yeah, when I had raced, the last time I had raced in Australia was for a triathlon, part of the ITU circuit to get to Rio.
Yeah.
And I'd gone down there, and in the process, I had gotten a tweet from a father of a young girl who was born with the same congenital disease that I was born with that affected her leg, and she was born with PFFD, and her wears a brace, a prosthetic leg on her leg as well. And so he had sent a tweet saying, "Hey, we'd love to come. My daughter's disabled. You're her idol. Would love to meet you." And I was like, "Yeah, come out to the race." And sure enough, Matilda and her family came out and saw me race when we were down there for this triathlon. And, you know, I still, you know, had a couple of exchanges on social media with the family. And, you know, and I just know that the example of running, it matters. And it also, it has a global reach, you know. And so, I mean, I thought about Matilda for sure when I was in Perth this time. It was the other end of the country, so I didn't expect to see her. You know, she's from Sydney, and I'm in Perth, which is, you know, it's a big country. So you know, hours away by plane. So I didn't expect to see Matilda, but, you know, that's why I was doing this whole thing, was to, I'm raising money for Challenge Athletes Foundation, and I'm doing it for girls like Matilda, for boys like Logan, for anybody who will encounter a disability in the future that, you know, that they can go to CAF, but they also have the example in the sense that, you know, they know that there's no limits, that if they want to do a 5K or a marathon, that it's possible, and we'll help them get there. So I carried a lot of that with me and tried to lean into that in those moments in every race. And in every race, I did have a lot of examples where CAF has touched lives, you know, so... So there really was a lot of inspiration there, even though I struggled to find it in Lisbon. I had no problem finding it in Australia or Cartagena or other places.
One of the reasons that Matilda story hit me was because, you know, you think about it, you're there, you're trying to make the Olympics, right? It's really important how you place and the rest of it. And this family came before the race and wanted to get a photo. And you think about it, if you're an elite athlete, it's like, listen, I'll talk to you after race. This is really important. This is a bit important race for me. But the reality is your real message is I'm here for you. I'm here so that you are motivated to go do what you want to do in your life because I'm doing what I want to do in my life. So that putting the race is great, but the real medals are those kids, right? That's really what you're out there for.
Absolutely, you know, and it's funny, I had remembered that I had talked to them before the race, but to me, it's like, it's not a detail I shared with you in the retelling, because I would have done it the same way again, no matter what. Like,
of
it
course.
Was right before a race, like, we're about to start and get jump in the water in 20 minutes, and I'm trying to qualify for Rio, and, you know, this little adorable, like, 5-year-old girl and her father are like, let's get a photo, and I'm like... You know, I would do it all again anyway, but it was kind of crazy timing. And
right.
But actually, truthfully, too, it helped me dig deeper out there, and I won that race, you know?
Yes, you did. That was awesome.
So I mean, I feel like I owe that victory in part to Matilda and her family, even though, you know, the timing was funny. But and I think, too, you know, I have to acknowledge that the sting of not going to the games is still very raw, I'll be honest, you know.
For me, too.
The fact that ITU and Paralympics gave slots to people who'd only been racing triathlon for 6 months, you know.
Well, and really, we wouldn't be in – paratriathlon would not be in the Paralympics without Sarah Reinertsen. Exclamation point. I mean, that's just the reality is you helped put the sport on the map. And really with the Ironman finish back in 2005 and with everything you did to create awareness for the sport of triathlon, because back in the day, we didn't have a lot of athletes in a lot of countries. We needed more athletes in more countries. And you should have been on the starting line for the first ever paratriathlon. That's, again, just my opinion.
Well, and I mean, that's my opinion, too. You know, and I feel like I was going to all these races when ITU needed to show there were women. And then once everybody else showed up, they just, you know, they picked the younger girls, and I got shoved out. And so that was hard, but I put that fuel into this race.
Because
I just knew that, like, okay, I didn't get to go to Rio, but I'm going to race around the world and do something bigger. I mean, so, you know, there was a little bit of ego involved, too, but that kind of frustration, I definitely put it into the miles, you know. And I think we all have disappointment in life. I mean, I share this not because I want pity. I'm sharing it as this is my fuel. This is what I needed to do to process it. And I think in life we all have things that, you know, we need to process, whether it's, I don't know, divorce or death or someone has, you know, in your life has, you know, a serious illness. And sometimes there's that fuel that helps us get out there just to process those tough moments in life. And so for me, this event, this race around the world, has helped me get out of that disappointment of not making it to Rio. It helped me process and feel strong and feel confident again.
What's funny is I was just interviewing Lionel Sanders, who took second in Kona this year and mm-hmm. led till mile 24 or so, 23 and a half, 24, and he talked about the inspiration of second. Right. He said, yeah. I would have been inspired if I'd won the race because I knew it wasn't I didn't have a great race. You know, he said, I had a great swim, great bike, didn't have a great run, ran 251. Patrick Lange was better. But I am so inspired now and so motivated now because of the motivation of second. Right. You had that motivation of not going to Rio, and that sort of lit a fire to go find that next challenge. How is it different today? When you were a little girl, there's no internet, right? There's none of that type of stuff to find what is out there for someone who's missing their leg above the knee. How is it different today for kids who basically are going through what you went through as a child?
Yeah, I think we have created an expectation where, kids can be active, you know, that they should be integrated, that they should have a spot on the cross-country team or on the lacrosse team.
Yep.
Or, you know, so that's what I think is really different, you know, and that's what I'm super proud of. And because I got a lot of Facebook messages and, you know, stuff from different families. And I mean, just the pictures I saw of kids, you know, running with their bib numbers and out there. And
yep.
Some of the photos that were sent to me too of you know, of their grandkid or their daughter or their son, you know, I'm looking at these pictures of these kids and they're they're out there with gloves on and they're running and it's or it's raining. And I'm wow, we have this whole generation of kids that we are teaching that they can be tough and powerful and not coddled and left on the sidelines, you know. So I think it's really cool. And I think a lot of that comes from the extreme examples, right? In some ways, by taking it to an Ironman
yes.
or to this crazy 7-day race, it sort of pulls the excuse away from that kid should also be doing the 1 mile on the president physical fitness test, right?
Right.
So
it's we what I think Challenge Athletes Foundation has had a great impact on is changing that perception that you can't do something, that they're really, you know, then that when I look at just this, you doing the 777 and the Rudy doing the run up Empire State Building along with Tara Butcher and
yeah.
her brother, both of them amputees, and John Siciliano on the TV show Bull is an amputee.
Yeah.
Just look at the showcase for all of the folks who've been, you know, been involved with the foundation, with CAF from the very beginning, and just seeing that Sarah, Rudy, Scout, these are one-named celebrities. We used to feel like we need to have celebrities at our events. It's like, no, we have celebrities. We have,
yeah.
Sarah's a celebrity. Rudy's a celebrity. Scout's a celebrity. Willie's a celebrity. Our athletes now have reached out and our mainstream media folks. And I think that's been a huge change.
Yeah, and I also have to, you know, give a shout-out, you know, in the sense that I think we've all helped to amplify the message. There's nothing that I could have done alone to help create this change. It really took a whole team of athletes. And beyond our challenge athletes, I think it also takes all the other folks that have been supporting the challenge
Absolutely.
Athletes, whether that's race directors or our, you know, for lack of a better term, our able-bodied athletes, right, who also have helped amplify the message. You know, it's the women's movement needs men to get there. the disability sports movement. We need our able-bodied counterparts to, you know, help amplify the message. And so it really has been a team effort that I think has helped change this cultural shift that we've seen.
Well, if you think about it, think about Robin Williams, and you think
exactly.
about you know, Will Ferrell, and all the different folks who've been part of CAF over the years and have given credibility and pointed a spotlight at our athletes and said, hey, I'm here. Media comes out to see them. They come to see Robin Williams at San Diego Triathlon Challenge, and they see Sarah, and they see Rudy, and then they go, oh, these guys are pretty amazing.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, that's who I was thinking of.
Yeah.
Was Robin Williams. I
Absolutely.
Mean, the fact that he used his platform to shine a light on what CAF and all of our athletes was doing. Yeah.
So what is next? Like you said,
oh
of course,
my
it's
gosh.
It's a little early.
You know, I'm still struggling. I'm open to ideas. So
okay.
Actually, if anyone wants to float me some ideas. I am looking for the next thing because I do think that you have to, even if I'm going to have to sign up for something soon because
yes.
this is what happens. After any event, you go through that post-event little funk and you need to find that next thing.
Yes, you do.
So I'm looking for that next thing I can really dig my claws into. But I will tell you, the morning after we finished in Miami, Tuesday morning, we have not even finished the race 24 hours ago at breakfast, talking to Dave McGillivray, and there may be a chance that I
run Boston.
Might be back in Boston doing something.
I would love that. I'll be doing my show from there. You need to come.
Okay, yeah.
That
so
would be great.
I think that's going to happen. We're already, a lot of us are talking about that. So so for the short term, it's looking like I'll do something in Boston.
Very
cool. And we'll see after that. But, you know, I definitely need to do something because
yeah.
Yeah,
because you have to. So, how is the how's your leg after all this?
You know, I have a lot of chafing on the top of my leg. That's starting to come back a little bit. I had a pretty bad blister on the bottom of my stump. That's going to take a little more time to heal. But you know, I'm on the mend. I mean, that's why I haven't run yet since Monday. I'm actually thinking if I can get it healed, I would like to run this weekend, but yeah, until that heals, I really have to kind of stay off of it.
I think you should. Hey, Sarah, first of all, congrats on 7 half marathons in 7 days and 7 continents. It's pretty unbelievable. That adds to the Ironman and the amazing race and your book in a single bound and everything else you've accomplished. But more importantly, what you've done to take CAF to another level has been really, really spectacular. And I'll always be appreciative for everything you do. Because all these little girls, man,
yeah.
they're starting with Sarah Bears, right? They've got the little bear with the prosthetic leg that they're brought in the hospital. And mm-hmm. they're understanding that they can be not just like anybody else, but anything they want to do is there for them.
So true, yeah. And, you know, we had a lot of CAF supporters that were also doing this race, so it was really cool to get to share this experience with some of our longtime CAF supporters, you know, like David Sampson, Martin Franklin.
Yeah.
You know, they were out there doing this race, too, so they also have been part of this movement.
I just
want to acknowledge them. So thank you, Bob.
You're very welcome. Sarah Reinertsen has been our guest. She's ready to go for a run with you tomorrow. Just give her a call. Again, we are brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series, by VeloFix, the world's coolest mobile bike shop, by Polar, Chase Your Destiny, Premium Plus Sports, official travel provider of the Tough Man Triathlon Series, our Challenged Athletes Foundation. Sarah is a spokesperson for the amazing Challenged Athletes Foundation. Last year sent out 2,448 grants, totaling $3.7 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check us out on Babbittville or at iTunes. And as always, endurance lives here.